Welcome back to the Confessions Podcast, Season 2. This season, we embark on a profoundly important journey, one that brings to light the stories, struggles, and triumphs of Black women living with HIV. In a world where the numbers speak volumes, with thousands of new HIV infections among Black heterosexual and transgender women, it's crucial we listen, learn, and act. Black women's experiences in the HIV epidemic are not just statistics. They are tales of resilience, strength, and hope. This season is dedicated to uplifting their voices, shedding light on the disparities in healthcare, and exploring the courage it takes to live openly and authentically. Join us as we share the courageous stories of six women whose lives and experience offer insight, inspiration, and a call to action for all of us. Welcome to Confessions, Season 2.
I am Bridget. I was diagnosed at 40, and I'm 51 this year, so 11 years living with HIV. I was born here in California. I grew up in Inglewood, which is like a little suburb of Los Angeles that a lot of people don't know about. I remember growing up, my neighborhood was pretty mixed, Black and Hispanic for the most part. We had a big park that we all used to go play at. So white picket fence. So even though it was a single parent household, it was just my mom, I had a lot of fun. I was the tomboy that climbed the tree in the front yard and almost broke my ankle a couple of times. And we had a little separate room in the back that I got stuck in the fireplace in one year because I got in there and panicked. There were a lot of things about my upbringing that I didn't realize would influence some of my decisions I made as a teenager and as a young woman. My dad left when I was about 4, and I remember that day distinctly because I ended up with a nosebleed. One of them caught me with an elbow during their little scuffle, and that's what stopped them from fighting, is my nose bleeding. My mother had a couple of other not happy relationships, and it basically set me up to be the kind of woman that wasn't going to take any shit. I am the oldest and the only girl. I have 4 brothers. My parents had myself and my brother, and then my dad had some other kids. I grew up with just the brother that's closest to me. My younger brothers, I saw a lot as they were coming up, but they came considerably after. My dad was absent a lot from our lives. And when he started coming around, like for me, it was great. I was the one that was more like my dad, and my brother was more like my mom. And so for me, when he was around, I felt very full. And when he wasn't, I didn't feel that. My relationship with my mother was, I can't say that it was strained, because it wasn't. Like, she was my mom. There were a lot of things that we disagreed on. There were a lot of things that she wanted that I didn't want. I left to join the military when I graduated from high school because I didn't want to go to college. And college wasn't like really discussed a lot in my household. It wasn't an expectation, but the idea was there. And I actually had to emancipate myself in order to be able to join the military because I graduated at 17 and that was what I wanted to do. And I think my mom had reservations about that, but she never really said anything. I can say that our relationship got better while I was in the military through letters. My military life was cut short. I ended up getting pregnant and having a baby. I separated from active duty. I finished out my time in the reserves. At 19, it was like, okay, so what are you going to do now? So I have worked for the phone company. I have worked for the gas company. I have done customer service. I got my HIV diagnosis through what was supposed to be just a random pap smear. I had gone to a healthcare clinic because I had a sore throat and I wasn't feeling well and I was turning 40. And all of a sudden, just in this short period of time, I had developed allergies. And so I went to a free clinic because I wasn't working at the time. I made too much money on unemployment for Medicare, Medi-Cal, but I didn't make enough for private insurance. This was before Obamacare. I went to this clinic, I paid a sliding fee, and as I was paying the sliding fee, the receptionist was like, hey, we're doing a free woman's program. Do you want to have a pap smear? And I was like, sure, why not? She's like, you have to come back tomorrow. No problem. It's free. I'm coming. I go in to get the results of this pap smear, and at the time that I had the exam, the doctor is asking me questions. She is feeling my lymph nodes. We're talking about these allergies that I have, this sore throat that I have. And hindsight, knowing what I know now about HIV, I think that she suspected something because she was like, we're going to do an STD panel. And I'm like, okay, no problem. I'm safe, right? Like a million other people. And she said, why don't we do an HIV test while you're here? And I'm like, why don't we? Let's go ahead. When I was back in that office getting the results, I remember she walked in with this manila folder. She opened it up and she started flipping papers over. So she's like, you're negative for gonorrhea. You're negative for trichomoniasis. You're negative for chlamydia. And I'm, you know, ticking off on my fingers. Like, I'm not a nurse at this point, but I'm not dumb. Like, I know things. And she goes, however, in my head, I'm like, oh, syphilis. But then I'm like, no. And she's like, you have the antibodies for HIV. Because at the time, it was a test where they run the blood test. If it comes back positive for the antibodies, they run it again. And then they consider you to be preliminary positive, is how she put it. You're preliminary positive for HIV. And I literally could hear the clock on the wall ticking. And she's still talking. And in my head, I'm hearing, if anybody remembers the Charlie Brown cartoons, maybe I'm dating myself, but the Charlie Brown cartoons where the adults always sounded like womp, womp, womp. That's what I was hearing in my head. And she's still talking. And so I finally had to say, wait, stop. Like, I don't know a lot, but I just need to understand. Are you telling me that I have HIV? And she said, yes. And it was just like, the world stopped in that moment, because who at almost 40 expects to get that diagnosis? And I knew about it. I had friends that had HIV, but which is also why I knew there was a difference between HIV and AIDS. But I wasn't gay. I wasn't white. I wasn't quote unquote promiscuous. I wasn't a drug user. I wasn't any of these things that you're supposed to be to have this diagnosis. And yet here I was with this diagnosis. I can't even say that I was like, what am I going to do with my, like, in that moment, it was just that moment of trying to absorb it and figure out how I had gotten there. You know, you're supposed to do partner notifications. You know, you're supposed to call people and your partners and find out, you know, potentially who you had given it to. Or who had given it to you? Where did it come from? Because it doesn't fall out of the air. I only had four people that I needed to call. And numbers, for some reason, matter to people. I think that it makes people feel secure to think that the type of sex that someone like me who has HIV had is different somehow than the sex that they have. And the truth is, it doesn't matter if it's one person or five people. Or 99 people. If you don't know someone's HIV status, you're vulnerable to contracting HIV. And it just happened to be the luck of the draw for me. The clinic that I ended up ultimately going to have the confirmatory tests and to start my care was not the clinic that I got the diagnosis from. And I was seeing this slightly older white gay man. And it distinctly felt like he could care less about this Black straight woman sitting in front of him with this diagnosis. Every time I would go into the clinic, those first few visits, someone would make it a point to tell me that I wasn't going to die, as though that was somehow comforting in the face of, cool, I'm not going to die, but how am I going to live? Like, none of you are telling me that. You're telling me I'm not going to die. You're telling me how good the medication is. You're telling me that the medication's not toxic, but you're not telling me how to live with this diagnosis. And I think to really drill down to it, the first couple of years living with HIV was me trying to figure out how not to die, both physically and emotionally. Because we all know, HIV is not a death diagnosis anymore. But emotionally, while it's not a death diagnosis, it is something that you kind of have to be reborn through. Like, you have to come out a different person than you were when you went into it. And it's like being reborn a little bit. Most of my friends were absolutely wonderful. It took me a little more than a year, I think, to tell most of my family. And some of them didn't find out until I went public a couple of years ago with my status. But disclosure is different depending on who you're telling, right? Like, it's different to tell a potential boyfriend or potential sexual partner that you're living with HIV than it is to tell a family member. And this is just for me. I find it different because the relationship that you have with these people is very different. Disclosing my status to my brother, I hesitated to tell him, not because I was worried about whether or not he was going to be ashamed of me or what he was going to think of me. I hesitated to tell him because I knew some part of him was going to hurt for me and worry for me. And that is the feeling that you get when you tell family members, is especially if you're close and you have a relationship, you don't want them to worry about you. You don't want them to feel pain. You don't want them to treat you differently because they're worried about whether or not you're going to live or die, because there's still so much ignorance. And by ignorance, I mean the ignorance of not knowing. There's still so much ignorance that surrounds what HIV is and was that people have a hard time understanding the concept of you're not going to die, right? Like, I'm fine. I'm taking my medication every day. I'm keeping it pushing. That's not to say that there's not obstacles. Like, mental health is a thing. There's an element of depression in HIV in and of itself because of what it's doing to your body. And so those are things that you have to deal with. But it's hard to explain those things. So my village, my community, have for the most part been very, very accepting. There's one or two people that stopped talking to me. There was one of the persons that I had to notify, like to say to go get tested. His reaction was, dang, what if you did this to me? Not thinking, dang, what if I did this to you? And I think that moment when he said that to me was the first little spark in me of, oh, hell no. Like, I'm not going to live like this with people pointing a finger at me when we do the same behavior. We're doing the same thing. You had sex with me just like I had sex with you. So there is just as much of a possibility that you gave it to me and vice versa. So it's different depending on who you're disclosing to. So the very first person that I told was my cousin, who is like my road dog. We do trips together. We're very different. Listens to rock music, loves Elvis, has a pink flamingo on, or used to have a pink flamingo on her patio, right? So she's very different than me. But she is one of my people. She actually was the first person that I told. And in that immediate time frame, she's the only person that I could imagine telling. I think because I recognize that she could hold that and hold my secret, because it was a secret at the time. But I also recognize, because women know other women, and I recognize that she has a core of strength in her that would help me. Her reaction was that it didn't change the way that she felt about me, and that she would support me in whatever I needed to do to get through it. And part of what I'm saying about her having that core of strength to help me is in the fact that there wasn't a sense of despair from her. There wasn't a sense of, oh my God, like, I can't believe this happened to you. I'm so sorry. Like, right? It was like, I'll help you get through it. Whatever has to happen, let's get through it. And that's, like, critically important to have. It also was my first lesson in understanding that not everybody deserves your story. When you talk about disclosure, for women living with HIV, there's this sense of guilt and this sense of, I did this to myself, and also a sense of responsibility as nurturers and caregivers that you don't want to do it to someone else. And so disclosure for me, because I didn't have the choice, it's always important to me to disclose to give someone the choice. Even with, you know, U equals U, undetectable is untransmittable, and knowing that I can't sexually pass my virus to someone because I'm on my medication, it's still important on a spiritual, moral level for me to disclose. But I'm also old enough to know that Not everybody deserves my truth. Not everybody deserves my story. I don't have to tell every person that I'm potentially dating the first or second time that I go out with them, because they may turn out to not be anybody that I want in my life. And so why do I have to share? But I also recognize that disclosure is mine to give. And just recently, I heard another HIV positive woman say that she doesn't call it disclosure. She calls it sharing. And I absolutely love that. I am so going to incorporate that into my language now, because language is important to me. I am currently taking for medication a drug called Dovato. It's a 2-drug regimen, as opposed to a 3 or 4-drug regimen in a single pill. So it's still a drug cocktail, but it's in a single pill. I made the switch because I was having some terrible side effects on the previous medication that I was on, which I won't name because not everybody has side effects on the same meds, and I don't want to bias anyone. I was having some side effects, and at 50, I'm already taking other medications. And so it made sense to me to try to lower, even if by 1, the number of medications that I'm taking. And so the Dovato has been working for me. I struggle with adherence, and it is for different reasons every single day. Sometimes it is that I forget. Sometimes it is that I'm busy and I know I'm supposed to take it, but I'm busy. Sometimes I am laying in my bed and realize I haven't taken my medication and that I got to get up and go get my purse, which is in the other room. Lord have mercy. And then sometimes it's just flat out resentment that I have to take this medication to stay healthy. Everybody's journey with their HIV medication is different. And as a nurse, I have to say, do as I say, not as I do, and take your medication. But just know that as a human being, sometimes we don't. So when it comes to the injectable treatments, I have actually thought about it. I actually was going to volunteer for a clinical trial, which is also something that I think women really should consider when it comes to a life with HIV. Even if the clinical trial doesn't benefit you in the immediacy of the moment, it may benefit another woman or several women 2 years down the line or 3 years down the line or a year down the line or whatever the case may be. I have considered injectable, but because I was on the injectable birth control hormone back in the day and it wasn't a positive experience for me, I'm just not ready to make that leap yet. I consider it and I go back and forth on it all of the time because it absolutely would make adherence that much easier for me. But it is something that I need to come to a decision on in my own time. I have a 32-year-old son, which is wild to say. And I don't remember when I told my child, because he's still my child, even though he's a man. I remember I could see him turning it over in his head and he didn't say anything. And that's the thing about my family in particular. None of them ever really say anything to me. They all assume that I'm fine because, you know, I am who I am and I seem like I'm fine. And most of the time I am fine. Sometimes I wish they would ask, but I've come to understand that everybody copes with an HIV diagnosis in their loved ones in different ways. Sometimes people smother, right? They want to be on top of you and bother you about taking your meds and be all up on you about being healthy, and that's fine. And then there are others who are kind of like my family, which is if I don't say I'm struggling, then I must be okay. And it's okay. It's a balance and it's not right or wrong. It just is what it is. The end of 2019, the beginning of 2020, I won an award for being one of the 100 top Black advocates in HIV. And nobody knew that I was advocating. Like I said before, I'm an HIV nurse, and so I take care of my patients and I do what I need to do for my patients. I had at that point been writing a column in a magazine called Positively Aware. It's called Being Bridget. It's about my life as a Black woman living with HIV. And so I had been doing all these little things to advocate for people, but I wasn't public about it. I wasn't hiding it, but I wasn't talking about it. Like, it wasn't on my social media. It wasn't something that I listed as part of my job duties. everybody knew that I worked in an HIV clinic, but they just thought that I was nursing in an HIV clinic. And so the end of 2020, I made the decision because of some of the things that I wanted to move forward and do and the way that I wanted to show up for other people, specifically for women and for people that are aging with HIV, because I'm very firmly in both of those categories. I needed to be public in order to do that. I needed to be able to post things on my social media. I needed to be able to have these conversations without them wondering why I'm having this conversation with them. And so I basically did a Facebook Live and was like, hey, this is what it is. It had gotten to a point by then that I really was forgetting who I had told and who I hadn't told. Like, I was telling people, like I said, I wasn't hiding it. I just wasn't being out loud with it. And for a lot of people, when I did the live, things kind of clicked like, oh, now it makes sense. I tell women all the time, if you never, ever go public with your status, if more than 4 people never, ever know your status, you're still advocating for women because you're showing up for yourself when you go to your appointments. You know, if you bring issues to your clinician or your doctor and you talk about them, they remember that for the next woman that's sitting in front of them. So there are a myriad of ways to be an advocate and to show up for yourself in your life with HIV that you're still showing up for other people too. In my mind, the way that I have learned to deal with stigma is I view stigma as bullying, right? Like, a bully picks on you and bullies you for a couple of reasons. Either they see something in you that they don't have in themselves that they want, or they see something in you that scares them, that makes them feel insecure. And so if they pick on you about it, right, it makes them feel better. So stigma is, in general, people's way of feeling safe, of feeling like it can't happen to me because I'm not who you are. I can't get HIV because I didn't do the things that you did. And so for me, the way that I fight stigma is to show up as who I am and my whole authentic self every chance that I get. Like, I'm all of these things. I'm a Black woman. I am a nurse. I am a mom. I am a grandmother. I'm somebody's friend. I'm somebody's aunt. I'm smart. I'm funny. I'm cute. I'm all of these things. And if I show up as all of these things, and also I happen to have HIV, what can stigma do to me? Absolutely nothing. That's not my problem. That's your problem. You want to try to bully me, you're going to come up against a brick wall. Rejection is a little different. I have definitely faced rejection when disclosing my status to someone who is interested in me or that I'm, you know, talking to or dating. But I've also come to realize in those situations that if I was the best thing since sliced bread and Jesus before you knew my status, I'm still the best thing since sliced bread and Jesus. Now you have an issue, particularly knowing that I can articulate and explain about what undetectable is untransmittable is, what U equals U means. The fact that, you know, you've known me XYZ amount of time and never knew, I'm still the same person. At 40, I didn't think I was ever going to date again. I thought it was done. I had this diagnosis and I thought I was done, which really pissed me off because 40 is when you hit the hormonal stride and, girl, my hormones were kicking. If I could have had sex every single day, I would have, right? That's hormonally. That's part of the stigma around HIV, right? Like, you're not supposed to talk about a sex life. You're not supposed to want a sex life. You're not supposed to be having sex. That is not reality. I'm still a human. I'm still a person. I still have raging hormones. I still want the intimacy and the connection of feeling loved and feeling physical touch. And so I don't hide my status. And there are people who are willing to learn and who are willing to be accepting of my diagnosis. And so I've definitely had sex since my diagnosis. I've had some really good sex. I've had some really bad sex, which is not different than before my diagnosis, which is just another layer of I'm still who I was before I got HIV. I've been in a couple of relationships since my diagnosis, but I am not someone who is going to settle for something just because of something else, right? I'm not going to stay in a relationship that's not working for fear of not being able to find someone else, because that's not fair to me and that's not why I was put on this earth. The biggest accomplishment anyone can find in an HIV diagnosis is to find themselves if they didn't know who they were, or to reaffirm themselves, the rebirth that I was talking about. I have done things since my diagnosis that I never imagined I would do. I don't see myself as a writer, but I have a whole column in a magazine, and I get requests to write things. I have become a moderator for webinars and talks, and I never saw myself in that role. I am an educator. I'm a teacher. I'm a nurse. That in and of itself, I got a certification for a specialty in nursing. It's an ACLPN, so I'm AIDS care certified. That's another accomplishment. There are all of these things that I never thought that I would be able to do or never even entered in my head to try to do that because of HIV. Like, some of these things may have happened in their own natural order because everybody has a purpose and what's for you is for you. But at 40, for me to just now be discovering these things, right? Like after this diagnosis at 40, for me to now be discovering all of these things, and I've had all of these things happen to me between then and now at 50, my world has very much opened up. The best advice I can give to a woman struggling with HIV is that you get to know who you are within your diagnosis, whether that means finding out everything you can and understanding the virus, or if you are a person who would rather just take their medication and not worry about anything else. Whatever that means, find that, because how you feel about yourself will really reflect and show up in how you allow other people to treat you.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through season 2 of the Confessions podcast. The stories shared by the brave women on our platform are more than just confessions. They are a beacon of hope, a call for understanding, and a plea for change. Until next time, take care and continue to listen, learn, and advocate for women. Stay brave, beautiful, and strong.